the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for January the 13th, 2019, the second Sunday of the new year. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we go from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. So it looks like I will be getting a new right wing after all. After consulting the medical gurus, I will be undergoing surgery on Thursday and be getting a replacement right shoulder.
Hmm. Are you going to be posting the progress of this?
No, we're not going to Facebook Live this thing. No, sorry.
Thank you. Don't do that.
Please. No. But
Had to ask.
I was kind of taken aback by the diagnosis. And then after getting a look at the x-rays, it was obvious. And but I will tell you, I have not been taking pain meds. I'm just not a big... You know, a couple of aspirin, ibuprofen, you know, that kind of thing. I've never really gotten into that kind of pain med stuff. But, you know, I was kind of deflated after I visited the doctor and stopped down at the Billy Goat. And I see WGN's own Todd Manley down there sitting with a gentleman at a table and having a cheeseburger. And it turns out it was Doc Emmerich. The great Mike Doc Emmerich, who was just on with Steve, and who listens to WGN religiously, and he knew I'd injured the shoulder and was in a sling, and you know, said, "What's going on?" And I said, "Well, I'm still waiting around here for a couple of more chats with the doctor, but it looks like surgery." And I said, "I'll get a final diagnosis on Friday," and that was the case. But I have to tell you, you know, it was the best pain relief I had, was sitting down with Doc and just telling stories. And, I mean, hockey stories, stories about the old Chicago Stadium. And Doc had never been to Billy Goats before.
That was his first time?
Yes. Wow. Yes. And, I mean, truly, it was empty. You know, it was mid-afternoon. Place was empty. And it was just a great pain prescription, I will tell you. It was to chat and laugh and
well, you took your mind off, you know, what was going on. So, sure.
Yeah, but I mean, when you have a guy with his history and me, my love of the game going back, you know, when my dad used to take me to the stadium in the 60s and those kinds of things.
Right.
Oh, we just laughed. And it was just, I came out of it feeling so much better. I mean, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It, you're right. It did. It took my mind off everything, but yeah. It was just fun, you know, and an unexpected fun.
Yeah, you could talk about all the great players you saw, the great players he has known and still knows. Yeah, I love that type of thing.
Yeah, so Doc, thanks for listening as always, and thanks for your support. And truly, you don't know how much you helped me that day, because that was just it was a great needed relief from everything. And I've got a very positive attitude going in on Thursday. I've got a great doctor over at Rush, and knows his stuff, knows it very well. And my one regret is that he wasn't a team doctor for the Blackhawks, but but he's done stuff for the Sox and the Bulls, so I mean, he knows his stuff.
He knows what he's doing.
Yeah,
you're in good hands.
I feel in very good hands, and I feel very good about going in with this, because it's got to get taken care of, and there's work to be done.
Yeah, you know? I'll make you feel better, because my dad's slightly older than you, more older. Actually, he's less than slightly older than you. He's 76 now. He had his shoulder done the other about a year ago, and said that it was the best thing he ever did.
Well,
because he was in so much pain. He said both knees done and a shoulder, and the shoulder he rehabbed from very, very quickly.
Yeah, well, and that's the expectation is surprisingly quick on this. And, you know, what the surgery I'm having was 6 years ago considered experimental.
Mm-hmm.
And only 6 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And now it is the preferred route to go. And so I'm looking forward to getting back to the daily grind. I feel bad about not being able to make it to Springfield for all the inaugural festivities, but I'm not sure that all I would be was just be in the way. So So good things lie ahead. So they're
and good luck
and best of luck.
Well, thank you. And you know, it's hard to believe. Just last Sunday, we were singing the Bears' praises. Mm-hmm. And,
you know, we would have to bring this up.
Well, then came the double doink. And Andy, if you remember, I mentioned something about the wins,
mm-hmm.
and you said something about kicking and don't go there.
Yep.
And I did not go there.
I know you didn't.
I did not go there.
But we knew it was going to come down to that, didn't we?
You know, it shouldn't have. That's my view.
No,
it should never have come down to that. And I was curious, and I haven't followed the Bears as closely as I should have this season.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept asking, where's the offense?
Yeah, the thing that happened in that game, unfortunately, I think Matt Nagy on his call sheet, play call sheet, always has the words B, period, U, period.
Right.
He wants to be himself. And all season long, we've seen gadget plays. We've seen some trickeration, for lack of a better word. Three quarters of that game were played as conservatively as I've seen him call since the very beginning of the season.
That was the way I looked at it.
Yeah.
It was just very, very conventional.
You know, and you know, you can talk all you want during the week, and I think we talked about this on Sunday before the game, too, that the message was this game just doesn't mean as much as everything else, but, you know, come on. These guys know that this is the playoffs. This is the NFL playoffs, for goodness sakes, and it does mean something. And you can try to get that mindset going as much as you can during the week. But I think it affected him a little bit. And it's not a bad thing. I think it's kind of natural that does happen. And I think he tried to recover late, and you know, the offense started to move a little bit. But then there was some time management issues, first and goal for the Eagles, and they're running the ball on first down and second down and not calling timeouts. There's a lot of things that happen, and unfortunately, it comes down to a kicker trying to put that ball through those uprights that he's had a hard time doing all year long. And you know, don't get me started on the NBC Today Show thing with him showing up on that. Which
still
I
trying
was,
to figure that
was
one
absolutely
out.
Absolutely ridiculous. But you know, it comes down to that, unfortunately. And we talked about that all year long. That the one bad spot that the Bears had and may not have had an answer for was the kicking game. And I tell you what, Pat O'Donnell didn't do them any favors either. Their punter late in the game with a horrible punt.
Well, and Robbie Gould was at the game.
Yes, he was with his kids. They were sitting in a skybox. And, you know, it got into a debate, and I don't know how much of this you were paying attention to in the week, but about how much time Cody Parkey actually put in at Soldier Field kicking during the week. I know there was a lot made when the Channel 9 helicopter flew over and it caused a little bit of a stink with the Bears and with the fact that they were flying over and taping what he was doing there. But, I mean, I had read and I remember covering the Bears of Robbie Gould and Paul Edinger back in those days. And those guys during home weeks would not kick at Hallis Hall. They would kick at Soldier Field.
Right.
And this was a relatively new thing for Cody Parkey.
And he just knew what was going to happen.
Oh, I know. The worst thing was that he kicked the first one, knowing that they were going to call timeouts.
That's why I knew it was going to happen.
And, of course, the first one goes right through.
Yep, right.
And, you know, everybody's happy, but nobody sees the timeout being called, and then doink, doink. Actually, it was tip, doink, doink.
Tip, doink, doink.
Yeah.
And the tip doesn't make it any better.
No, it doesn't, because it was heading that way anyway. I don't think the tip really affected it all that much.
I kind of do like the way NBC kind of promos these games as one game. This isn't like the playoff in the other sports.
It's
you
true.
Know, like in hockey, it's not a best of seven. It's one game.
No.
And I can't fault the defense.
No, the defense did its thing. I mean, yeah, they bent a little bit, but you know what? You got to have some help. You have to be off the field for a period of time to gather yourself and to rest up a little bit and then get out there. And then, you know, they were out on the field quite a bit. And, you know, now the defense loses its leader with Vic Fangio heading over to Denver. But I really like the Chuck Pagano hire as the defensive coordinator now. I think that was a quick and a very decisive good hire by the Bears.
Yeah, I think I still think good things ahead. There's no doubt about that.
There's a lot of talent there, and it's young talent under contract.
Right, under contract.
Which is really good.
Yeah, a very good thing. I watched some of the Kansas City Colts game yesterday, and I haven't seen a lot of the Chiefs. I have a lot of friends who are Chiefs fans and things that I follow on Twitter, and they were I saw the first half. They were pretty impressive.
Yeah, they were good. This is a good team. It's been snake bitten for so many years. They had not won a home playoff game since 1993, and Joe Montana led that team to a win.
Wow.
That's how long ago this was. So this is going to be the first home AFC championship game for the Chiefs in the Super Bowl era.
Huh.
Think about that. Back to 1966.
Wow.
First time they've ever hosted an AFC championship game. And it'll either be the Patriots or the Chargers, depending on the outcome of the first playoff game today.
Bring out your Hank Schramm red sweater.
Exactly.
Right?
You marked it good. You marked it good. Love those NFL films.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. That's and Arrowhead's a great stadium, too.
It's an awesome stadium. The only bad thing about Arrowhead is there's one road in and one road out.
Yeah.
And yesterday, with it snowing, I was hearing stories from people that were going there. It was taking them a couple of hours even just to try to get into the parking lots because of the fact that it was all snow-covered.
Didn't stop them.
No, it didn't. They got about 75 or 76,000 fans in that building.
Yeah, that's something else. So what are we looking at today?
Well, today you've got the matchup of the oldest quarterbacks ever to start in an NFL playoff game, and Tom Brady against Philip Rivers. It's going to break the record of Brady and Peyton Manning from a couple of years ago. The Chargers are playing really well, and of course you never count out the Patriots and Bill Belichick or Brady in a playoff game. I do think that the Chargers may have enough to get him this time. I think
really?
they may get him this time. I think Philip Rivers is on a mission. He had a chance in there in 07, but he had a torn ACL and played in the game.
So,
and still played pretty
that
well
hurts,
in 07.
Andy.
Yeah, how about that? So that's one of the game I think that the Chargers may get there today. And then
that's in Foxborough.
It's in Foxborough. Yeah, and the other game, of course, is the Saints and the Eagles. And I don't really care because the Saints are going to win. And if the Eagles win, I'm turning the TV off.
I just figure the Saints are going to win that one.
I think they'll roll.
What do I
know?
Well, yeah. I'm sorry. Who did we pick last
exactly
week?
Exactly right. That's why I will not rest on any laurels.
Well, I'm still counting on the figuring the Saints for the Super Bowl so I can get rid of all that red beans and rice that I'm going to be making for quite some time. So, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy's here with the latest sports. Producer Cassara's fielding your calls. She's at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're also on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Brett is busy looking for my hospital gown. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. And you can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Up ahead on the show, we'll speak to Chicago mayoral contender Bob Fioretti, and we'll talk to him about his campaign and where he fits into this multi-candidate field. After the 8 o'clock news and sports, we'll speak to Lou Lang. He's a former top Democratic leader in the Illinois House, and the Skokie lawmaker now just recently resigned to join the lobbying world, and we'll talk to him about his career and what he sees ahead in the General Assembly. And then after the 8:30 news and sports, we'll speak to a good friend of the show, Pat Brady, former state Republican chairman. Brady was a staunch defender of Governor Bruce Rauner, and we'll talk to him about how he sees Republicans under this Democratic domination of Springfield. That's all up ahead. But now it's time to launch our spin through national politics. And, you know, we're still in the partial government shutdown, the longest government shutdown. Paychecks aren't being sent to the Secret Service, TSA workers, and thousands of others. Trump wants his $5.7 billion wall. Democrats say no. And that has the president increasingly looking at declaring a national emergency on the nation's southern border.
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. The lawyers have so advised me. I'm not prepared to do that yet. But if I have to, I will. I have no doubt about it. I will. I have the absolute right to declare this was passed by Congress. So when you say, was it passed by Congress? It was. Other presidents have used it, some fairly often. I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. I haven't done it yet. I may do it. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
So he says that, but then the following day he says, well, I'm not really there yet on declaring a national emergency. This kind of going back and forth as the Democrats continue their resistance, and slowly some Republicans saying that they need to see something to jumpstart getting the government and workers their paychecks. After a brief meeting with Democratic leaders last week, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi forecast problems with Trump's own Republicans if he made that national emergency declaration.
I think the president will have problems on his own side of the aisle for exploiting the situation in a way that enhances his power, but not to go there. Let's see what he does. Right now, there is a path. Open up government. Let's have this discussion on where we can agree on the best ways to protect our borders, to secure our borders, to do so in a way that honors our values.
But after that meeting, Trump had this to say about attempting to deal with Democratic leaders like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer.
We have a lot of great things happening. The economy is incredible. We're negotiating and having tremendous success with China. And I find China, frankly, in many ways, to be far more honorable than Brian, Chuck, and Nancy. I really do. I think that China is actually much easier to deal with than the opposition party.
So China is easier to deal with than the Democratic opposition. On CNN, Illinois Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger said he thinks that a deal could be reached on both sides, but both sides have to put down the political shields that they're wielding.
If it is, again, if it's an agreeable bill, agreeable appropriations, I'll reopen as much government as we can. But Democrats are going to have to come to the table and compromise. You know, we are too. It's not going to be just our way or the highway. You know, I think there's people that probably don't want to go attach DACA to something like this. We're going to need to do that. But this is like a super easy issue to solve. And this is what just frustrates me out here is we can all solve this, and it's like an 80% agreement with when we're done. It's just nobody wants to give anybody a win or anything else. We got to get past that, or we're going to continue in this stupid shutdown idiocy cycle for the rest of our time out here, and that's got to stop.
That's Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois. Now, we had the president saying yesterday on a tweet, quote, we will be out for a long time unless the Democrats come back from their vacations and get back to work. I am in the White House ready to sign. A long time. And there's talk that even the Trump administration is looking at plans for if this were to extend for another 6 weeks. So nothing apparently moving on the horizon. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by Chicago mayoral candidate Bob Fioretti. Good morning, Bob.
Good to be here. Thank you much.
So, tell me, as a candidate in this multi-candidate field, I mean, obviously it's been reduced somewhat through objection processes, but still, how do you separate yourself from everyone?
Well, I think it's getting the message out. Obviously, in this day and age, it's all about dollars and cents. But we do have a pathway. We know the amount of votes that we need to get, and we're trying to stick to that path and not deviating from it and making sure we get every vote out on Election Day. I have to tell you, though, as you know, I ran for county board because nobody else wanted to stand up, and all of a sudden my name was bantered around. I think the polls show that we were pretty equal on or around Election Day, but really nobody voted in the county board race. The turnout was like 21% at that point. So we need a good turnout. We have to get our close to 88 to 100,000 votes out, and hopefully it won't be too cold or snowy of a day.
Well, what is the path as you see it?
Well, we know where our pockets are in wards throughout the city.
I mean, it's really kind of, and this is true for any candidate, really, the way this is fractured up, isn't it, in among constituencies?
Well, I think, see, in my area of what we need to do, I have pockets out of every constituency. And I think if we can make sure that they get out, and I feel... wherever I go, I feel an energy because I can walk down the street and people are saying, I'm voting for you. And I think people are honest when they stop you in a street, in a restaurant, in a church, at the forums that we've been at, the people who I don't know. But we got to make sure that they then get out to vote and they're motivated enough to vote. And because the problem, a lot of my constituency are people that are really disenfranchised with the city. They feel like they're at wit's end. They can't find good educational opportunities for their kids. They're struggling to get their kids in the school. They're struggling at their jobs, and they feel the impact of high taxes, property taxes, and most of them are just saying, I want to get out of here as soon as possible.
They're the disaffected.
Yes, that's what they are.
But aren't they also the ones that are harder to motivate to then become active in the political process?
Well, yes. That is what needs to be done to get them out. Most of them already have a couple-year plan, a five-year plan that's saying, I'm out of here. Whether it's a police officer, fireman, whoever's out there, especially in the public sector group
employment
of people, they're all feeling that. There is a big move. I was just recently in one of the restaurants in Greektown, and I was at the back end. As I was walking out, I had five different people from five different tables tell me as I was walking out, saying they're leaving our city, and it's all because of high taxes, lack of educational opportunities, and a lot of them are going to Florida, Tennessee, Georgia, and Texas.
Obviously, we know the issue about city taxes, but is there, you know, a confluence there with the fact of state taxation
too? Oh, yes, and I think they feel that, too. I think they feel, these are hardworking, honest people, but they feel engulfed in the corruption and the taxes here in our city and our state, and they just don't know where to turn, and they feel the best way is out. A lot of them, a lot of people who have kids or grandkids here in the city, a lot of them are moving to Indiana, across the border. They make it easy so they can take the South Shore in, work here, and try to deal with their everyday life problems by moving to Indiana and staying close to their family.
Well, to me, I mean, education has always been a significant issue for the future of this city, especially with some of the regentrification. As we talk about people moving out, you also have, younger people that want to be in. It's not cheap. Then, they get married. As soon as they have a kid, they're off to the suburbs.
And I've seen that, when I approved and we moved United Airlines into, I still call it the Sears Tower, and we moved them over, I knew that we had a younger demographics from Elk Grove. And a lot of them lived in the suburbs. I thought, well, if we move them here, they can, and it was just the beginning of what happened in the South Loop and West Loop. They'd look out the windows and say, why do I have to go all the way up to the northern suburbs? Why don't I move here? And they did. I would see people in Mary Bartlemy Park, a park we created, and people would say, hey, Alderman, I'm one of the people that moved here from, and I'm working at United in the Sears Tower at the time. And I would say, oh, well, great. I'd see the same people a little bit later. This is my girlfriend. We're getting married. They have a kid. And a couple years later, they're moving out to the suburbs at that point. And that flux is happening, and we have to see if we can keep people here.
Well, how do we do that?
Well, one, we need a freeze on property taxes, no matter what. We can't keep taxing our citizens. We've got $10.2 billion budget. We need to find ways to keep our taxing structure under control. Secondly, we've got to open up the educational opportunities. They should be available across the board. I mean, granted that the funding is now maybe helpful from the state, but it's just not enough, especially in some of our neighborhoods. We need to reduce crime. Because no matter where we go, people are talking. They fear. They have a fear that of crime. We've got to try to eliminate that, and more police on the streets, more police, on foot patrol, bicycle patrol throughout all of our neighborhoods will help eliminate some of that. But at the same time, we need to bring jobs and economic opportunity to all of our neighborhoods, after school programs, wraparound, which are social services to help in the high crime areas. At the same time, we have to reopen our mental health clinics. I think that's one of the top priorities in fighting crime here in our city. We can talk about more police on the street. We can talk about adding more detectives, but we need to open up our mental health clinics. You know, here we are on Wacker. We go to Lower Wacker. There's Tent City up and down. You get off of the Dan Ryan right over at Taylor Roosevelt Street. I mean, they have a massive tent city under every viaduct. We need to help those folks so they can find some sort of productive lives in whichever direction they want.
Speaking about bringing economic opportunity to the various neighborhoods, and obviously when we look at the South and we look at the West Sides, what, as mayor, what can the city do to spur that economic development that's a key component ultimately in the crime and education issues?
Well, it's bringing, yes, it is. It is a component. You hit it right on the head. But the first thing we need to do is stabilize our neighborhoods. We need to create tax-free zones, in my view, to bring businesses. But at the same time, we need to stabilize the housing and the affordable housing. The foreclosure crisis hasn't ended in parts of our city. It's continuing. We need to find ways to help people refinance homes, get them on a steady opportunity that they can find some growth. People who are still working are in foreclosure. I just had an individual who talked to me yesterday. He's got a condo down in Hyde Park. He works for the county. He's in foreclosure, can't make it. These are the type of things that we need to stabilize our neighborhoods. One of the more interesting aspects out of the latest tax bill that was signed in Washington are opportunity zones. Those are creating development without displacement. And everybody knows, I mean, Chicago was targeted for a lot more opportunity zones than any other city. MSNBC jumped on it. Why Chicago? Why Chicago? It's because we are really a distressed area, distressed city in our South and West Sides. And hopefully we can have people come in, develop the areas, bring in the jobs. We have about 50,000 vacant buildings in the city of Chicago. We ought to find ways to rehab them and bring them back to life. Once we stabilize our neighborhoods, we can have growth and economic opportunity.
Well, in those economic opportunity zones is kind of a private-public partnership issue, and allowing private developers and businesses to get a tax break for investment purposes.
Mm, correct.
But I don't see anybody kind of spearheading how this should be done.
Well, I'll tell you why, because nobody knows how to do it yet. The president just signed the executive order, I think a few weeks ago in December. So it took off at that point. We need to look at it carefully and make sure it's development without displacement, and that's been the aim of it. I am in some discussions with certain people throughout that can come into the areas and see what we need to do. I think in the next 2 weeks we'll be able to crystallize this area, and I think it'll take off and help our neighborhoods.
We're speaking with Bob Fioretti. He's a candidate for mayor of Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Bob Fioretti, mayoral candidate for the city of Chicago. Obviously, the issue of property tax is a significant issue. You've made it a significant issue. But you also point out that there's only a certain amount of property taxes that's under the city's control, and that a lot of factors go into property taxation. So beware of people who blanketly propose a property tax freeze.
Right, but the mayor's office controls the Chicago Park District and really the Board of Education. And we should be looking at those portions, too, to make sure we have a freeze. But, you know, the way you overcome this problem is by bringing in small businesses, economic growth, expanding our tax base. You know, I spent my own money going to other cities, talking and seeing what they were doing, talking to businesses, going to a lot of cities here in this throughout our country, and trying to bring in. And I was successful. I had to fight people to bring in the Target. I had to fight the governor's office to bring in the Costco at 15th and Ashland. The Trader Joe's was a joint venture between how that was arrived here. The expansion on Rush. Where we created, I brought 8,000 jobs, and most of them were from the neighborhood. Part of my understanding with all the folks that we brought in was to hire from our neighborhoods, because I do believe that if you hire from our neighborhoods, that's it. You know, we could talk about where the South Loop and West Loop is now. That was all because of the work I did, and really, as a full-time alderman, 50, 60 hours a week, you have to strive to do that. For your constituencies. It's unfortunate, though. I was involved in land use for the last 20 years, so I understood how you can bundle properties, put them together. Pete's Grocery, I had to fight the administration because people didn't think that would be a successful store there. We had bids on it from various high-profile grocery stores, but Pete's ended up. Look at it at Western Madison right now. It's booming, booming. And we have to target, we have to know how to, people are not, aldermen are not professionals in land use or in zoning. And that's been the problem. We need to target our south and west sides, especially bring in the jobs, hire from our neighborhoods, train at Rush. We had a 18-week training program at Dawson over at 36th in Michigan, and most of those people are still working at Rush at this point. Almost 10 years later.
Aldermen aren't experts at land use and those kinds of things. What about aldermen's prerogative, then?
Well, I think that's got to end. I really do. I mean, the whole thing about permits and sign-offs, especially when they, redistricted me. They redistricted me at the beginning of the term. And then they all of a sudden decided to implement it, which is probably, there was constitutional issues. But,
The new map.
The new map.
While the old, before the new terms had
begun. Right, exactly. And in some of the wards, people were sitting on permits. They were sitting on variances. I had three different small businesses that needed a variance. They were 7 months into their lease. They'd been waiting for almost a year for the alderman to sign off and approve the variance, and they were almost ready to go into bankruptcy, these three different entities at different times. We need to help foster small businesses. Going through a bureaucratic process of allowing an alderman to sign off on it, I would sign off on things as soon as they came in if it was good. I would also tell my police commander that this is here, so they were aware. And then I'd probably call up the commissioner who was in charge of that, ask for a commissioner's order, and allow the business basically to open up tomorrow. What happens is, under the bureaucratic process, if you don't know how this commissioner order, you would have to wait, see your alderman, have him or her sign off on it. It then they got to go back to business affairs. Business affairs then introduces it on your behalf in the council. You sign off on it. It then goes to a committee meeting. It's either approved or disapproved at the committee. Then it goes again to the city council. Another 90, 120 days. What are we doing here?
What about, we talked about education, what about the issue of elected school board in the city of Chicago?
Well, I've always been in favor of an elected school board. I was the first one out. You know, I received the Defender of Public Education Award from SCTU. What's surprising is none of these candidates are all in favor of elected school boards. There are some kind of, and they all say it was bad to close all 50 schools. Where were they when I was on the front lines fighting for our students at that time? None of them were at any of the community meetings. None of or the congressional hearings that were held at one of the churches, or any of the school board meetings that were held on this issue. I was there every day fighting for our students, because that's the key. But you talk about an elected school board, I do get worried about special interest controlling. I think anybody who's a vendor, whether it's a CTU or a contract person, they shouldn't contribute at all. There should be a flat prohibition on them contributing to any candidate. We do not need special interest controlling our elected school board.
I mean, some people have talked about the hybrid type situation too, some mayoral appointees, some elected appointees. I mean, is that a functional way to kind of circumvent that issue of special interests?
Well, it may or may not be, really, because, you know, well, let's face facts. Somebody like a Tony Preckwinkle, who's controlled by the CTU and SEIU, she'll do whatever they say, and she'll make the appointments on whoever they say. You know, we see that often. So the mayor, I would hope, you know, we've got 13 candidates right now on the ballot. I would hope that if we can get one good idea out of each of them to move this city forward, I'll be very happy. Because we have the problem that we are faced with. You know, we can talk about crime, education, bad budgeting, and that's how I got into this race, and now all of a sudden the candidates are pivoting towards answering those questions. But the pension obligation is the biggest problem we have.
You knew my segue perfectly. That's exactly okay. Where I was going.
All right. And you know, we right now pay in out of our $10 billion budget, we pay $902 million into it, $900 million into the pension fund. Next year alone, we have to pay $400 additional. The next year after that, $600 million. Next year, $800. And then it goes up to $1 billion. We will be paying $2 billion a year into the pension fund. And if we can't find ways to fund that, then guess what? We are going to be eating away at police, fire, social services, the regular sanitation pickups across the board. And we have to do that using, I'm going to have budget hearings across the city. I'm going to go, I always enjoyed my ward night because we solve people's problems. I'm going to have ward night in every ward. I will go to every ward throughout the year and just to deal with constituents from those wards. I think people in this city have some good ideas, if not great ideas, a lot of them do, if not most of them. And I have been, since in 2010, all the things that the mayor's been talking about, I've been talking about a long time, except for pension obligation bonds, which is just another kick the can down the road.
But what do we do about the pensions?
Well, in 2010, I called for reform in the pension system during the budget hearings, and Ed Burke got up and said, we were forced to take pension holidays. We can't do this. We can't do that. Yes, we can. But I have been, for the last 6 years, talking about a commuter tax. 1% out of people who live in Indiana, Wisconsin, in the suburbs that work here, would generate about 300 $200 million. If we would have had that just directed towards the pension fund, we would be in a much better shape than we are. It's an issue of fairness. It's an issue of equity. Because people who come from the suburbs, they want good streets. They want good safety on our streets as they go to their job. If something happens to them, they want an ambulance before they fall down on the sidewalk. You know, we can't tax the people of the city anymore. That is over and done with. We cannot raise taxes on them. So I say that we need to keep fighting on where we're going, see what we need to do across the board, and that is one option. I'm all ears. If people have other alternatives, they can follow me on social media at my Facebook, or they can go to me on Twitter or whatever and send me their idea. I'm all ears. I will listen intently. And no, it won't kill jobs. You know, everybody says that was Rahm's, when I proposed it 6 years ago, he sort of started, he had people in the media, his favorites, saying, oh, it's a job killer. No, it's not. Chicago is the economic center. People want to work here. And go to Union Station at 4:30 to 6 and see the thousands of people that are leaving the city. Or down here at the IC, the Metro, you can see them all going to the suburbs. And we need to rein this in. And Chicago has a spending problem. You know, and it's not a revenue problem. It's a spending problem. Maybe I can find ways to cut the budget even more and provide the services that are necessary.
That's Bob Fioretti, Mayor candidate for the city of Chicago. Bob, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Great to be here. Thanks, Rick.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome to your second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. The 101st General Assembly was sworn in Springfield on Wednesday, and one longtime representative was not among those being sworn in. Democratic State Representative Lou Lang of Skokie resigned just a few days before the inauguration to enter the business world, as they say. Representative Lang joins us now on the phone. Lou, thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be with you, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. What prompted your decision to step away from the General Assembly and go into the lobbying business?
It wasn't my plan to do that. After the election, I simply got a fantastic business offer that I could not in good conscience reject. So that was the one and only reason. It happens. Lots of people have left the General Assembly to move on to what someone might call greener pastures, or certainly different pastures.
And you've been in the legislature since 87. I mean, you have a wealth of experience in the General Assembly.
Certainly, I've seen a lot of things change, a lot of things happen in almost 32 years. And, you know, in terms of public policy and in terms of the agenda of the Democratic Party in the House, this was actually a good time to leave. We now have 74 Democrats in the House, the most we've had in a very long time. We have a Democratic governor, and I think they'll be able to put the agenda and the public policy goals that we all share together.
Well, you've said you've seen a lot of changes. What's the biggest change you think that you've seen in Springfield?
The lack of bipartisanship. And so you'll recall that just recently, after Bruce Rauner became governor 4 years ago, we devolved into a mess in Springfield because he was unwilling to sit at the table with Democrats. He had hard and fast views on things, and he didn't understand that Springfield was a place of compromise. Governors that have been successful and legislatures that have been successful have been those who have been willing to sit with both sides and not worry about who gets the credit, but only worry about the people that live in the state of Illinois. And indeed, the budget stalemate of 3 years was only broken when Republicans said to Rauner, go away, and we're going to get this done, and sat with Democrats and negotiated a budget.
Isn't that symptomatic, though, of our politics in general, of that the idea of how Republicans and Democrats more than ever politicians play to bases that are at the further extremes of what the general populace is, and that in playing to those extremes develop these hard and fast rules that make compromise so difficult?
Certainly in general, that is exactly correct. So a lot of members will say to a sponsor of a bill, gee, I'd really like to vote for that, but that'll hurt me in my next primary. They're not often worried about their next election in a November election. They're more worried about their next primary being hit from the left or being hit from the right, depending on who the candidate is or where they are. The legislature will improve, and the tenor of politics in Illinois will improve when members realize that the easiest way to get reelected is to do your job and to do it well and not worry so much about pandering to one group or another group. We have much too much of that.
But isn't that hard to do when necessarily you have big moneyed interests that are, you know, willing to support primary challenges to incumbents?
Certainly it's hard to do, but we need people who are statesmen. Take the 15 Republicans who chose to vote for the compromised budget that was put together that finally broke the three-year stalemate. Those are people who were not worried about being reelected. And in fact, a couple of them, I think, lost. Several of them did not run for reelection because of the pressure of Bruce Rauner and his people. While this is a hard goal to reach, it's a goal we must reach if we're going to have the kind of support from people that the legislature would be able to thrive better in.
Well, let me ask you this. Is perhaps maybe an issue of more fair redistricting would create that kind of a playing field, where, as you say, you know, people are more concerned about winning a primary than the general. Would a more fair map-making process, a more nonpartisan map-making process, maybe play into that?
So I've heard this discussion about maps before, and I don't really buy into it. And the reason I don't is that, first, every map that's ever been drawn in my career, we've had several, mostly written by Democrats, one written by Republicans. Every one of them goes to court. Every one of them is scrutinized by a federal district court who passes on those maps and says, yes, they're okay. And in fact, no map has ever been rejected in my years in the Illinois General Assembly. So, additionally, when we've drawn maps, we've drawn them to increase minority participation, which is what we're supposed to do under the Federal Voting Rights Act. Drawing maps by computers, drawing maps in ways that other states that aren't quite as differing as Illinois in our population, doing it that way would mean we'd have two or three less African-American legislators, maybe two or three less Latino legislators. The maps we have drawn, if you look at them, maybe they look funny, and certainly we could use some reform in our map-making process. But the whole discussion that people have that we have to throw the map process out because it's inherently unfair is belied by the fact that the federal district court always approves them.
We're speaking with former Democratic State Representative Lou Lang of Skokie. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joined on the phone by former Democratic State Representative Lou Lang of Skokie, who's entering his second career in public service, working on the other side of the other estate, as it were, in politics, I guess is a good way to say it. Lou, you said leaving now, you know, with Democrats in control of state government, with J.B. Pritzker to be sworn in tomorrow, bigger Democratic majorities in the legislature, you feel comfortable that it's a good time to move into a new realm here?
I think so. If ever I was going to leave, I wouldn't want to leave at a time where some people in my caucus felt my voice was more needed than it will be. 74 Democrats, you need 60 to pass a bill. We're in good shape. The Democratic Party is in good shape. The people of the state of Illinois are in good hands with that legislature and with Governor Pritzker taking the reins. I think if I was ever going to leave, this is the best time for me.
And Greg Harris was named as the deputy majority leader.
A spectacular choice, a good friend of mine, and in fact, the person I predicted would become the majority leader. He is going to hit the ground running. He knows how legislature works. He knows how the budget process works. He's got the respect of the members on both sides of the aisle because of his hard work, and Greg will be a phenomenal majority leader.
And I do have to agree with you. I think he does have a great deal of respect on both sides of the aisle, particularly with his work in human services appropriations efforts.
Absolutely. So before he came the overall budget guru, his specialty was human service budgeting. And, you know, with scant resources, he did a yeoman's job in putting budgets together. Obviously, during some of the rounder years, there were tremendous cuts. He had to go through those budgets, figure out how to smooth them through and how to keep as many of the human service agencies afloat as he possibly could. Some during the rounder years got hurt badly. Some people have lost their services. Some of those organizations will never reopen. But Greg is the guy that kept many of them open and providing great service to the people of Illinois.
So looking at these early days and what is still a transition period as we get to inauguration at noon tomorrow with the new administration of Governor Rauner, I mean, we're hearing lots of kind of, I don't want to go as far as to say kumbaya, but actually some pretty good comments from even the Republican minority leaders in the House and Senate. Even the fact that Pritzker showed up at a reception for the Republican legislators, that, you know, people seem to be looking at wanting to start anew again. And I think that's even something that Speaker Madigan touched on about closing one chapter and opening another.
JB is serious about bringing people together within the confines of government. He has said more than once, I don't really care who gets the credit. There's plenty of credit to go around. There are good ideas on both sides of the aisle. And he's very serious about creating the relationships necessary to do that. Governors in other states and governors in this state who have been successful have all been governors who have been able to sit in a room with people of divergent views and try to forge compromises and try to move forward. That is what he's done in the business world. That is why he won this election by 16 points, and that is why he'll be an excellent governor.
How quickly do you see change happening? And I mean that in a way, as we know some of the points that Pritzker talked about in his campaign, things like legalizing marijuana, things like trying to find resources and move forward with a capital bill. I mean, you know, as far as the marijuana issue, you're vastly familiar with that from your time in the legislature. But even things like a capital bill are not things that can happen truly overnight.
I think there will be a push to do some things early on, but I think the people will want to hold back the reins and make sure they do them well. A perfect example would be the recreational cannabis legislation. And so it'd be easy to say, well, let's do it. Let's put it on the board. Let's vote on it. Let's make it law. But from my efforts on passing medicinal cannabis some years ago, I know that there's a lot of branches and a lot of pitfalls, and it's far better to do it slower than it is to do it wrong. So speed is not always in the best interest of the legislature. Those things that they can do quickly, they ought to do quickly. Not every bill has 500 pages. But the things that take time, they ought to take whatever time they need to do them well, because sometimes once you do something, it's harder to fix than it is to write a new bill from the get-go.
What is something they ought to do quickly, do you think?
Well, I think they ought to start talking about revenue right away. I don't think you can address the needs of Illinois and address this year's budget the needs of the universities, the human service industry, et cetera, unless you know what revenue you're going to have. So that in some ways affects that marijuana bill you talked about, but in other ways it's just, are we going to, for instance, do a graduated income tax? If we are, let's get on it. Let's figure out what the rates are and try to move it. Now, that can't happen this year. We can put it on the ballot for 2020, but I think it would send a strong signal to the people of Illinois that we're serious about putting the revenue together that's necessary to take care of human needs and infrastructure needs in the state of Illinois. We should be talking about what components will pay for a capital bill. For those that are not listening, a capital bill is an infrastructure bill, fixing the schools and the roads and building hospitals and the money necessary to repair the University of Illinois and the other state universities, and a long list, roads, bridges. Those things require what's called a capital bill. It requires more votes to pass, but you have to have the money to pay for it. And so there ought to be attention paid very early on as to what components will go into paying for that bill.
Yeah, well, and that's what I mean. It's not only the what goes into a capital bill, where you prioritize, you know, the spending, but it's how do you raise the money to float the bonds. It's a very complicated process.
It is. The last capital bill we passed in Illinois, I was the proud sponsor of. It was a $31 billion capital bill. Some of the money came from the feds. Some came from video gaming. Some came from small increases in liquor taxes and some other things. It's hard to put it together because you're paying for the bonds over 25 years. And you want to make sure you do it right. On the other hand, if you do it right, you can fix a lot of things in Illinois that need to be fixed. Transit systems, water systems, healthcare buildings, the universities. The University of Illinois, just as one institution, has hundreds of millions of dollars of capital needs. And because those needs had not been met, we're actually losing faculty and we're actually losing students to other states. We have to fix that.
And I think truly the dilapidation of our infrastructure is a sad reflection on where this state has been drifting.
There's no question about that. But the interesting thing is that members on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers believe we need a capital bill. Now, some who believe we need it and some who are more than willing to have the money come to their communities won't be willing to pay for it. And that's something to watch out for.
Those are always the best votes to watch for, the guys who vote for the projects but don't vote for the funding for it.
Right. Well, I've always said if a legislator doesn't vote for the funding for the projects, his or her community shouldn't get the projects. Some think that's a little harsh. I don't. You want a bridge in your district, you help pay for it. You got to put the vote on the board to do it. But it probably won't happen that way. We'll probably end up putting a structured roll call together where we piece together the 71 votes in the House and the 36 votes in the Senate to make it happen. But I believe it will happen, and it will be a very good day for the state of Illinois, however it happens.
I kind of like that. That could be lose rule, you know, kind of a, we'll see if we can't slip that into the House rules a little bit.
I have a lot of rules, but they don't always follow them, Rick.
Understood. Lou Lang, former Democratic state representative from Skokie, thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you continued in Springfield. Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate being on with you today.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here in the Allstate Skyline studio for this segment is Pat Brady, former state Republican chairman, now with Next Generation Strategies. Pat, thanks for joining me this morning.
Glad to be here. Good morning. Sorry about your shoulder, buddy.
Yeah, I figured you would come in and, you know, give me a lot of grief about it, because it's not like I have enough dull pain going on.
I thought it was an old guy thing. I didn't realize it was an actual injury. So
yeah,
now
I know.
Now I feel bad for all the comments I conjured in on the way up.
The old guy thing. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Well, I wanted to have you in because as I said earlier, you were very much a staunch defender of Governor Bruce Rauner and during the reelection. And, you know, now we have the election. We have inauguration tomorrow. J.B. Pritzker, bigger Democratic majorities. And actually, I wanted to talk to you a couple of weeks ago and didn't get a chance to, about when Governor Bruce Rauner said that after the primary, which he narrowly defeated Jeannie Ives, that he went looking for people to replace him on the ballot. And I just found this kind of stunning. And one, I'm not sure what even making that concession public accomplished, but I thought it was, in essence, diminished what he was trying to do.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was an unfortunate comment, and I'm guessing that he would probably like to take that back. And it was in an interview with Craig Wall. It was almost kind of a throwaway question. And he went on a narrative and said that. And a lot of people like me and others that were fully invested in that campaign were a little disappointed that he would make that statement. Now, he kind of walked it back and said he was thinking that way because he wanted to win. And after the primary, with the conservative base of the party, he did have a lot of problems. Jeannie Ives lost by 3 points. So,
well, he found himself basically without a base in many respects, or trying to assemble a base.
Yeah, that was unfortunate because it got into more social issues and the fiscal issues. I think the 44 things that the governor was trying to get done, part of his reform agenda, a lot of the conservative base would have agreed with, but I think it got muddled with some of the other issues that came up during his time as governor. But again, it was unfortunate. I don't think that he probably would like to take that back, but he tried to explain it. But we can focus a lot on what happened in the last 4 years, but I think everybody's kind of trying to look forward now.
Well, I was curious what you thought of, for example, House Speaker Michael Madigan's address as he became speaker I think Jim Durkin said, it's deja vu all over again.
Actually, Durkin got up and said the first couple of votes in the exit polls had him actually winning.
Yes, you're right. Well,
CNN called it for him, but it didn't work out.
You can't rely on that, but... And let's face it, you know, here's Madigan. He's been speaker for all but 2 years since 1983.
The year I graduated from college.
Well, in 1982 was my first year covering Springfield. So,
and we're not young.
You've already established my bona fides on that one. But you had the speaker come out and basically say, you know, after 4 years of personal attacks and those kinds of things, and basically saying, I'm still standing, you're not, to Bruce Rauner. And but the speaker saying, let's close this chapter and let's start a new one.
Yeah, it's about chapter 85 for him. But the point is, and I was there when he made that, and to me, when you win or lose, I think you need to be magnanimous and move on, win or lose. And the funny thing from listening to that was the applause lines he got there were not great in a Democratic crowd. And the biggest applause line of the entire ceremony, I thought, was when Jim Durkin got up and talked about fair maps. And we need on both sides. And there were more Democrats in this room than Republicans. So I thought those comments were, again, unfortunate and probably unnecessary. Why don't we just look forward and talk about what we're going to do rather than talking about the past? I don't think that made him look better. He could have talked about a lot of things that he didn't do, but you know that's what he chose to do.
Well, I mean, and it's one kind of couples with those TV ads that have been running, which I think are once again just kind of a not a very expensive way to just kind of try to poke in the eye.
That's fine. That's politics, and we get the hardball nature of politics, but what purpose does that serve? The state has a lot of problems. We lost 45,000 people last year, $7.5 billion in debt, not a deficit. We're still running a deficit on our yearly budget. So, again, they're free to do what they want, but I'm not sure what purpose that serves or how that helps the people of the state.
We've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning. And Rick, first of all the best to you on Thursday.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Brick, you said everybody is ready just to move forward. As far as the Republican Party, what is moving forward now? Should they try to maintain the base, the conservative base, or after looking at these election results, are they going to be looking to appeal to what could be considered more moderate, for the So that's my question. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Ron.
And that's a great question, but I think any elected official, Republic, Democrat, or independent, whatever, should focus on policy and not the next election. And I think if that's what you do, you focus on good public policy, you'll do fine at the ballot box. So I don't think that there needs to be a determination by anybody what they're going to appeal to get reelected. I think they should just focus on good, sound public policy.
But when you look at this Republican Party, and I mean, obviously from your time as chairman of the state party, but even long before that, this kind of constant kind of battling that went on between, I would say, the socially moderate and socially conservative wings. I don't think it was ever really a division that existed among fiscal conservatism at all, but more along the social lines. And that's been a chafing that has gone on from social conservatives for a long time. And, you know, let's face it, to be a successful statewide Republican in the state, when you go back to 1982 and Jim Thompson, even and Thompson was already in a couple of terms by that point, but that was the secret of success, to be a statewide elected Republican official. And that gave the social moderates control of the Republican Party. And then you had the governor, Governor Rauner, comes in, installs his people there, but also having to try to placate social conservatives over after the primary. And there's a kind of a question of, you know, where does the party go? And is there now a vacuum for social conservatives to try to assume control of the state GOP?
And that's a good question, but let's take a couple things here. The Democrats are going to have the same problem, I think, in their caucus. They're much more, the House caucus, much more progressive.
I'm going to get to them.
Yeah. But the answer is this. We're a state that lost 45,000 people last year. The debt and deficit numbers I just talked about. I think to be successful, the Republicans need to focus on reform, a reform agenda. And the social issues of today, I think, are one of the social issues is property taxes. I pay more in property taxes in the western suburbs than I received in salary my first year out of law school. Property taxes, all the taxes we have in the state, why we can't provide social service, home values. There's an article in the Tribune a couple weeks ago about a home in Barrington that sold for $100 a square foot. We're getting killed. So there are issues that we can focus on that both sides can agree on, and I think those are the social issues of today.
But obviously, you know, in the political world, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and they get all the attention.
But they don't get the votes. And the reality
is... But what changes that dynamic, though?
Focusing on those issues. Governor Rauner got in a trick bag with the social conservatives on a couple votes that I think were the right things to do. Maybe there was a compromise in there that might have kept some of the social conservatives happy, but I think some of the people, Jeannie Ives and some of the people, they were dying to run against him, and they got a reason, and they did. And unfortunately, after they lost, they didn't get on board with our nominee, and that's why Governor Rauner, the election turned out to a great extent the way it did. The reality is, once we get through the primaries, we got to unify. We just didn't do it this time. And a lot of it's because they weren't willing to do it.
But what's to stop that scenario? Not of having a governor, but what's to stop that scenario of that kind of battle taking place in the next go round in a Republican primary?
You know, I think a lot of it, it sounds simplistic, is communication. I'm not sure if there was a lot of communication between, if you want to call it the divisions, the conservatives and the more moderates. I think the conservatives feel that they're left out in the discussions. I'm not sure if that's a fair criticism, but I've heard them say that. And the reality is, we've got to have those communications and realize, and it's what I said. I did an event at the City Club in March, and I said, if we are not unified, it's going to be Governor Pritzker, and it's going to be a bloodbath, and that's what it turned out to be. So that's why we're in the position we're in. The reality is that the party should be there, in my opinion, to get our candidates elected and push our agenda.
But you also have that purity aspect that sometimes creates martyrs rather than elected officials.
Yeah, and the purity component, the Policy Institute lobbying wing and the other people that want the purity test. I saw one comment, they've raised and spent $50 million and never flipped a seat. So I think the communication aspect of it is we need to explain to people that when you lose every election, you don't get any of your agenda done. And I think that's part of the going forward what should be done. But again, I think you just focus on the issues, the things we agree on much more than we disagree. And if we focus on those issues going forward, I think we can be very successful. I've always believed, not some people don't agree with me on this, and I've traveled all over the state and lived all over the state, it's not a far left or far right state. Illinois is actually, if you go up and down the state, a fairly centrist state. So I think there's a lane there for compromise and getting an agenda through that will actually turn the state around.
We're speaking with Pat Brady, former state Republican chairman, now with Next Generation Strategies. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by Pat Brady of Next Generation Strategies, former state Republican chairman. We were talking about the direction for this for the GOP in Illinois, but let's bring it more immediate here. As I spoke to Lou Lang earlier about the fact that you have Republican leaders, Jim Durkin in the House, Bill Brady in the Senate, kind of going into this new Democratic-dominated scene that we have in Illinois government, and actually expressing an optimistic tenure, and obviously
we got him right where we want him, Rick.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, that worked out well. A Democratic governor, expanded majorities in the House and Senate. I thought it was more than just the traditional kind of honeymoon type of kumbaya kind of thing, that there really is a feeling and a belief here that they are going to get listened to.
Yeah, I think they believe that, and I think it's a product of the last 15 years where we've basically had a civil war, even within the Democrats, from Speaker Madigan and Rod Blagojevich, and the most recent being Governor Rauner and Speaker Madigan. I think that Leader Durkin and Leader Brady, I think, truly have a good relationship with the incoming governor and will have a voice. But the role of the Republicans is going to be, the governor's got a very aggressive agenda.
Yes, he does.
And we heard Lou Lang talk about, the first thing they talk about is revenue, which means taxes. So I think this idea of a progressive income tax, I'm not sure if that's going to sit well with any Republicans. On the marijuana legislation, I'm not sure where that's going to sit, but we can't overtax it, so it just keeps it on the street. So there are a lot of issues that are going to come up in this session where the Republicans will have a voice, and a necessary voice, because, you know, the Democrats aren't going to take these votes without Republicans being on the vote. So the Republicans
are going to have some influence.
Yeah, it is political cover, but the reality is that they do need Republican votes. And I think it's smart. I've never understood how you go through an election and then get done and continue to whine about the election. It's over, you lost, now it's time to govern. The campaign is done. Now we need to govern. And I think Leader Durkin and Leader Brady are smart to say, hey, we want to work with the governor, but that doesn't mean we're going to compromise the principles that we believe in. But I hope they have a good working relationship. And I do believe that there is that center lane that I talked about before where we can get some things done and get the state moving forward. But for all the rainbows and unicorns talking about cooperation, we have some really tough, very difficult issues that are going to have to be decided in this legislative session, dealing with taxes and reform and how we're going to move this state and get out of the hole we're in. And those are going to be tough votes.
Well, and part of me, you know, a lot of people talk about, and this was even true at the national level, about doing an infrastructure bill, and that was a good first kind of step, should be a good first step to do. But at the same time, there's so much dependent on getting that little bit of pork and having a project in your district that, to me, it's almost like the last thing you should do at the end of session, because that could be the difference between passing something else that's on the agenda.
Yeah, and that's a good point. But the reality is we're a bankrupt state. Now, you can't technically be bankrupt, but we technically are bankrupt, or legally bankrupt. So we have issues we need to deal with. A bankrupt company doesn't automatically go out and start
buying
a new jet. You got to fix what the problems you have now. And those are the tough votes. I think a lot of people, I know a lot of people support a capital bill because we need it, but how are we going to pay for it? A gas tax? all these taxes they're talking about. Revenue means taxes. So that's going to be the debate, and the role of the Republicans will be to represent the taxpayers. It's amazing when you listen, as much as I love Lou Lang talking about revenues, but we never hear any talk now about reform, about reforming this government to make it more efficient so the taxpayers are getting as much bang for their buck as they can. And I think that will be the role of the Republicans.
Well, and as you touched on, I think property taxes are an essential issue. And I think that has become more and more the preeminent issue. But that opens up a whole issue of things such as how do we fund our public education in Illinois, which is the bulk of the property tax bill, and the concept of using a, as I've said before, a 17th century measure of wealth to assess taxation to fund our public education. I mean, that's why we have schools determined, quality schools determined by zip code.
Yeah, and the good news is we have a new assessor, which I think is going to bring some maybe more fairness to the assessment system here in Cook County. But it is a huge, complicated issue, and that's where the Republican voice needs and will be heard so we can get some kind of compromise to move forward. But it that's the most difficult issue. But I did a lot of walking during the course of the campaign out in the western suburbs, and that is the number one issue.
And you have a number of new Democratic legislators who are from the western suburbs, the former Republican firewall.
Yep.
And I mean, with those majorities, including the 74 votes that Madigan is part of, sometimes those majorities, you know, well, that looks good, it's a veto-proof majority, but they don't work in lockstep.
No, and some of the seats they won, if they take the wrong vote relating to property taxes, that'll be their last vote, because that is the number one issue in the areas where they picked up seats.
Well, and I even wonder, as you mentioned, the graduated income tax.
That's progressive not, income tax.
Well, I call it by what it is, graduated income tax.
Well, the thing is, we can have that debate too, which I don't think you're ever going to get Republicans on. But
no,
if you're
going
to do that, why don't we amend the Constitution to change the way the can't diminish pension benefits clause in the Constitution? I mean, there are compromises there, but that's one where I think that the Republicans, that they have a tough sell getting Republicans on that.
Oh, and I agree, but I'm not sure that there's 71 Democrats either, despite the fact that this was kind of a hallmark of Pritzker's campaign. Especially if you play the game, you don't know what the rates are.
And that was when you saw, I think, one downland state legislature proposed making the tax rates were just going to be absolutely ridiculous, particularly on low-income people. It was going to be ridiculous. So that debate, I don't think, should be front and center. That's just too complicated, and we have other things to focus on. And I hope the governor and the Democrats focus on the reform issues first, because if we don't, we're really at a crisis, and we've been saying that for years, but I think after you saw last year, at least people leaving, we really are at a crisis.
That's Pat Brady. He's with Next Generation Strategies, former state Republican chairman. Thank you, as always, Pat.
Hey, I want to congratulate Greg Harris, too.
Oh.
That's a great pick by the speaker. He, like Lou Lang said, just a hardworking guy, and he represents a lot of good things, I think, for the state. So congrats to him.
Yes, to the new Democratic majority leader, Greg Harris.
Thanks, Rick.